This is amazing, he said. You try to do a good thing, and you get hassled for it. Ballard pulled her phone and speed-dialed the watch office. Before knocking on Bechtel's door, she had requested backup, because Felsen and Torborg had been sent to another call while she had been down the street looking at video. Now she was facing a situation where she had to make a felony arrest without backup. Her call wasn't answered for 6 rings. While she waited, she casually took a few steps farther back from Bechtel, so she would have more time to react should he decide he didn't want to be arrested. Finally, her call was answered by a voice she didn't recognize. This is 2 Whiskey 25. Where's my backup?
I don't see that here on the board. You sure you called for backup?
Yes, 15 minutes ago. Send it. Now. No delay. And keep this connection open. Ballard barked the address into the phone, then refocused on Bechtel. She would find out about the missing backup later. Bechtel was sitting with both hands in the front pocket of his hoodie. I want you to take your hands out of your hoodie and keep them where I can see them, she said. Bechtel complied, but shook his head like this whole thing was a misunderstanding. Are you really arresting me? Do you want to explain why you climbed over the roof of the house across the street, broke in on the back deck, and took 3 artworks worth several $100,000? Bechtel didn't speak. He seemed surprised by her knowledge. Yeah, there's video, Ballard said.
Well, I had to get in there somehow, he said. Otherwise, somebody else would have, and then the paintings would be gone.
They're prints, actually.
Whatever. I didn't steal them.
Did you take anything else besides the prints?
No. Why would I do that? I just cared about the paintings. The prints, I mean.
Ballard had to decide whether to cuff Bechtel, to neutralize the threat, or to wait for backup, which now might be another 10 to 15 minutes away. It was a long time to wait with a suspect not fully controlled. The district attorney's office will decide whether a crime was committed. But I will be arresting you. Right now, I want you—
This is such bullshit!
—to get up from the chair and face the wall. I want you to kneel on the floor and lace your fingers behind your head. Bechtel stood up, but didn't move any further. Kneel down, sir.
No, I am not kneeling down. I didn't do anything.
You are under arrest, sir. Kneel down on the ground and lace your— She didn't finish. Bechtel started moving toward her. It was crystal clear in the moment that if Ballard pulled her gun, she would probably have to use it, and it would most likely be the end of her career, no matter how justified a shooting it would be. But what wasn't clear was whether Bechtel was coming at her or trying simply to walk around her and leave the room. He moved as if heading toward the door, but then suddenly pivoted toward her. Ballard tried to use his advantage, his weight and muscles against him. As Bechtel advanced, Ballard placed a well-directed kick to his groin, then took 2 steps back and to the side as he doubled over and lurched forward, emitting a sharp groan. She grabbed his right wrist and elbow, pushed the wrist down, and pulled the elbow up as she pivoted him over her leg. He went down face first, and she dropped all 120 pounds of her weight through her knees onto the small of his back.
Don't fucking move!
But he did. He groaned like a monster and attempted to rise, doing a push-up off the floor. Ballard drove a knee into his ribs, and he dropped to the floor again with an oof. She quickly grabbed the cuffs off her belt and clasped one over his right wrist before he realized he was being cuffed. He struggled against the next one, but Ballard had the leverage. She pulled the wrists together against his spine and closed the second cuff around the left. Bechtel was now controlled. Ballard got up, exhausted, but exhilarated that she had taken the stronger man to the ground.
You're going to jail, motherfucker. This is all a big mistake. Come on, this is wrong. Tell it to the judge. They love hearing bullshit from guys like you. You'll regret this.
Believe me, I already do. but it doesn't change anything. You're going to jail.
Bosch. Chapter 18. Bosch and Lourdes had spent the rest of the day watching Dr. Jaime Enriquez to see whether he would eventually make a house call. Enriquez was a native son of San Fernando. He was the kid who'd made good and stayed close. A UCLA-trained physician, he could have worked anywhere in the country. But he came home and now operated a busy general practice on Truman Avenue with two other doctors to handle the overflow of patients Enriquez drew. He was a San Fernando success story, having grown up in the barrio and now living in the lush Huntington Estates, the nicest and safest neighborhood in the city. But while outwardly he was a pillar of success and respectability, his name was secretly carried in the SFPD's gang intel files. Both his father and grandfather had been Sanfers, and loyalty, whether compelled or volunteered, ran deep. The secret of his life was that Enriquez was a suspected gang doctor, and Bosch and Lourdes were going to find out if he was treating the killer of Martin Perez. Lourdes's cousin, J-Rod, had put them on to Enriquez, saying he was one of three doctors of the gang unit's radar. But the other two had already drawn investigations from the state's medical board, and it was J-Rod's interpretation that for this case, the killing of a witness, the Sanfers would go to their top patcher, who lived a life that seemed beyond reproach. Most of the day had been spent on surveillance of the busy medical office, where Enriquez practiced. Both Bosch and Lourdes dodged calls from Sheriff's Detectives Lanark and Boyce, and as they watched the medical building and the Mercedes-Benz registered to Enriquez parked out front, they tried to figure out where the leak in the investigation had been. One of two things had happened. Someone had tipped the Sanfers to the fact that Martin Perez was cooperating with the police, or Perez had made some slip with an acquaintance or family member and had given himself away. Bosch and Lourdes believed it was most likely the former, and they spent their time running down the possibilities, dismissing some and holding on to others. Bosch had mentioned his suspicions about Tom Yarrow, the LAPD detective assigned as interdepartmental liaison to the execution of the search warrant, but Lourdes pointed out that Yarrow didn't have enough information about the case to set up the hit on Perez. Additionally, it had been Yarrow who had alerted Lourdes to Cortez watching the morning search from the parking lot of the laundry, but that could have been a sincere warning, or part of a more devious plan, to solidify Yarrow as someone on the pro-Bosch team. Yarrow was briefed for the search warrant, Lourdes said, but we never discussed your source in the briefing, and Perez was a John Doe on the warrant. Yarrow had no name, no location. It's a long shot, if you ask me. This turned the conversation uncomfortably toward the SFPD. Many of the officers in the department were from San Fernando, and it would have been virtually impossible to grow up in the 2-square-mile town without knowing somebody who was in the Sanfers. Still, that connection usually worked in a positive way. Many officers added to the gang intel files after street conversations with past acquaintances. Lourdes's cousin J-Rod was an example of this, and she could not remember an incident in her history with the department when information had gone the other way. That seemed to turn the conversation even more uncomfortably toward Bosch. What move had he made that might have revealed Perez's betrayal to the Sanfers? Bosch was at a loss. He acknowledged that he often left his laptop in the cell he used as an office. But the cell was always locked, and the computer was password protected. He knew that both could be compromised, but it still seemed like a remote possibility that a member of the Sanfer gang would undertake such an intrusion. "There's gotta be something else," he said. "Maybe we look at Perez again. Who knows? Maybe he called somebody, bragged about taking down Cortez. Nobody said he was very smart." "Maybe," Lourdes said, but her tone implied that she was unconvinced. Defeated in their efforts to figure it out, or at least settle on a focus, they let silence fill the car until they spotted a man approaching Enriquez's Mercedes-Benz. "Is that him?" Bosch asked. Lourdes held up her phone, where she had downloaded to her screen a photo of Enriquez from the DMV. "It's him," she said. "Here we go." They followed the doctor north and into the Huntington Estates, where where he pulled into a garage next to a two-story home with columns out front. The garage was attached to the house, and the detectives lost sight of the doctor once the door automatically came down. "Think that's it?" Lourdes said. "He's in for the night?" "If he worked on the shooter this morning, then I think he's got to check on the patient at some point," Bosch said. "Unless he died. There's that. Or unless he's in that house. There's that, too. So we stay?" "I'm staying. If you've got stuff to do, you can walk down the street and call an Uber. I'll let you know if he makes a move." "No, I'm not leaving you here alone." "Not a big deal. This is a long shot anyway." "Not what partners do." Bosch nodded. "Okay," he said, "but one of us might have to Uber over to Route 66 to pick up dinner. Haven't eaten all day." "Not a problem," Lourdes said, "if you like that stuff." Bosch didn't take the bait. They had good-natured disputes about surveillance food in the past. They were parked a half block from the doctor's house in the driveway of a home that was empty while under full renovation. Bosch had positioned his old Jeep Cherokee in front of a flatbed used for towing construction materials, and the old beater fit right in. The windows were smoked, and as long as they didn't light themselves with phone screens, they would go unnoticed by the doctor or others in the neighborhood. "Do you remember the music group Seals and Crofts?" Lourdes asked. "Yeah," Bosch said. "70s, right? They were big. Before my time, but I heard this is where they lived. The estates." "Hmm." The small talk continued for almost 2 hours until the discussion of food came up again in earnest. Lourdes wasn't interested in Bosch's hamburger and hot dog joint, and Bosch had long ago OD'd on all the Mexican restaurants in town. They were about to flip for it when a car came down the street and killed its lights as it pulled into the driveway of the Enriquez house. It was full dark now, but Bosch had identified the make of the car as it drove by the construction site. It was a white Chrysler 300. "This is it," Bosch said. No one got out of the car. It sat and idled, exhaust puffing from its twin pipes. None of the house's exterior lights came on when a figure emerged from the side and got into the Chrysler. "Is that the doctor?" Lourdes asked. "Can't tell, but I'm betting it is," Bosch said. The car took off from the Enriquez house and passed in front of Bosch's Jeep without slowing down. Bosch waited until it had turned a corner, and then he pulled out. The trick was following the Chrysler out of the residential neighborhood without being made. Once the surveillance was in the commercial district, it was easier to use other cars on the road as camouflage. Bosch and Lourdes followed it to San Fernando Road, and then north into the Sylmar region of Los Angeles. At Roxford, the Chrysler turned right and entered a neighborhood of middle-class ranch homes on quarter-acre properties. Just past Herrick Street, the Chrysler turned right into a driveway and parked. Bosch drove on by. Lourdes reported what she saw. "Several men," she said. "They met the car and hurried him inside." "Must have taken a turn for the worse," Bosch said. "So what do we do now?" "For now we wait."
"For what? This is L.A. We should call an LAPD SWAT and scoop them all up."
"We will. But let's wait till they get the doctor out of there. Now that we can prove he does work for the Sanfords, I think your cousin might want to flip him and keep him on the hook the rest of his days." Lourdes nodded. It was a good plan. Enriquez would be more than likely to be willing to trade information with a gang intel unit in exchange for avoiding the humiliation of being exposed as a gang doctor. "Except we still don't know who snitched off Perez," Lourdes said. "That could make things very dangerous for the doctor if he turns informant, too." Bosch nodded. "That we need to keep working on," he said. "But once we know who the shooter is, that might become clearer." Chapter 19. When Bosch entered his house, he was met with Elizabeth's suitcase sitting on the floor just inside the front door. It was actually his suitcase, but he had brought it to her on the last day of rehab, so she could pack her meager belongings. There had still been room in it for items they would shop for. Through the back sliders, he saw her on the deck on one of the lounges. He watched her for a moment, thinking she had not heard him come in. She was not reading or listening to music. She was not looking at her phone. She was simply staring into the pass, the never-ending movement of vehicles down on the freeway, like blood through the veins of the city. It was an aspect of the view that was always changing, but always the same. In recent years, the only addition was the fireworks shot on special occasions from the Harry Potter ride at Universal Studios. He crossed the living room, slid open one of the doors, and stepped out. "Hey," he said.
"Hello,"
she said. She smiled. He crossed the deck to the railing and leaned his back to it so he could look at her. "You're limping," she said. "Yeah," he said. "Guess I gotta go see Dr. Zhang." The previous year, Bosch had met Elizabeth while he briefly worked undercover on a case. He adopted a cane and limp as part of a pose as an opioid addict, scamming shady pharmacies for prescriptions. The irony was that during a struggle with a murder suspect on a plane, he had strained a ligament in his already arthritic knee, and now he made monthly visits to Dr. Zhang, an acupuncturist he had met many years earlier on a case. "I'll call her in the morning," he said. He waited for her to say something, but she didn't. "I saw the suitcase," he said. "Yes, I packed," she said. "I'm going to leave, but I didn't want to leave without telling you face to face. That just seemed wrong after all you've done." "Where are you going?"
"I don't know."
"Elizabeth, I'll find a place. You have one right here. Your daughter won't visit because I'm here. That's not fair to either of you. She'll change. Besides, I go down to see her. And she barely says a word to you. You told me. She doesn't even text you. We texted last night. You text goodnight, and she says the same back. That isn't a conversation. That isn't what you had before I came." Bosch knew he could not win this angle of the argument, because she was right. "We're getting close on the case," he tried. "This detective I told you about? I think she's all in. It's active. Just give us some time. We checked out a possible suspect last night." "What does it matter?" Elizabeth asked. "It doesn't change anything. Daisy's been dead 9 years. "All I can tell you is that it matters," Bosch said. "It counts. You'll see when we get the guy." He waited, but she didn't respond. "I'm sorry I'm so late," he said. "Did you eat something?"
"Yes, I made something," she said.
"I put a plate in the refrigerator for you." "I think I'm just going to go to sleep. I'm tired. My knee hurts. I'm going to get up early and go down to Hollywood Division to check in with Ballard before she goes home."
"Okay.
Will you at least stay tonight? It's too late to go out there without a plan. We can talk about it tomorrow." She didn't answer. "I'll put the suitcase back in your room," he said. Bosch turned momentarily to the view just as a single rocket trailing green light arced into the sky over Universal. It exploded with a flat bang, nothing like the real mortars he had heard in his life. He headed toward the open slider.
"Daisy sent me a postcard from Universal once," Elizabeth said. "It was before they had Harry Potter. They still had the Jaws ride. The card showed the shark. I remember that. It was how I knew she was in L.A.
Bosch nodded.
"When I was sitting out here, I remembered a joke she told me when she was little. She heard it at school. You want to hear it, Harry?"
"Sure."
"What happens when you eat too much alphabet soup?"
"What?"
"You have a vowel movement."
She smiled at the punchline. Bosch smiled too, though he was sure his own daughter had told him the joke once, and it made Elizabeth's grief hit him deeper. This had been the way he had learned more about Daisy. Elizabeth grieved and reminisced, and then shared the stories, all from before the girl had run away. She told him about how the stuffed turtle she had won at skee-ball at a fair became her most prized possession until the seams wore out. She told him about Daisy splashing in rubber boots through the flooded pecan orchards near their home. There were sad stories, too. She told Bosch about the best friend who moved away, leaving her alone. She told him about Daisy growing up without a father, about the schoolyard bullying and the drugs. Good and bad, it all brought Bosch closer to both mother and daughter, made Daisy mean more to him than just her death, and stoked the fire he warmed himself by as he pursued the case. Bosch held at the door for a moment, and then just nodded. "Good night, Elizabeth. See you tomorrow." Good night, Harry. He went in, noting that she did not say she would see him in the morning. He stopped in the kitchen, but only to put ice into a Ziploc bag for his knee. He put her suitcase in the room she used, then went to his own room and closed the door. He stripped off his clothes and took a long shower until the hot water was gone. Afterward, he put on a pair of blue plaid boxer shorts and a white t-shirt and used an ace bandage from the medicine cabinet to wrap his knee and hold the ice bag to it. He plugged his phone into its charger and set the alarm for 4 a.m. so he could get down the hill to Hollywood Station and work a few hours with Ballard on the shake cards before the end of her shift. He then turned out the light and gingerly climbed onto the bed, positioning himself on his back with one pillow under his head and the other propped under his knee, as the slight bend this created in the joint helped ease the low hum of pain. Still, the ice was uncomfortable, and it kept him awake until he thought the knee pain was numb to the point he could fall asleep. He unraveled the ace bandage and put the ice bag into an empty champagne bucket he kept next to the bed in case the bag leaked. Bosch was asleep soon and snoring lightly when the sound of his bedroom door opening woke him. He tensed for a moment, but then saw the female silhouette in the doorway, outlined by oblique light from down the hall. It was Elizabeth. She was naked. She moved to the bed and climbed under the sheet that covered Bosch, straddling her legs over his hips. She leaned down and kissed him hard on the mouth before he could say anything, before he could remind her that he was old and might not be able to perform, let alone discuss the propriety of having a relationship with the mother of the girl whose death he was investigating. Elizabeth kept her mouth on his and gently began to rock her hips. Bosch felt her warmth against him and reacted. Soon she was reaching to push down his shorts. Bosch's knee was no longer numb, but if there was pain, he wasn't feeling it. Elizabeth made all the moves and guided him inside her. Her hips worked in a steady rhythm, and she put her hands on his shoulders and arched her back. The sheet fell aside. Bosch looked up at her in the dim light. Her head was thrown back like she was looking up at the ceiling. She was silent. Her breast swayed above him. He put his hands on her hips to help lend his rhythm to hers. Neither spoke. Neither made a sound except for the deep exhalation of breath. First he felt her hips shudder, and soon after he desperately reached up and pulled her down into an embrace as his own body created that one moment that takes all other moments away, all fear, all sadness, and leaves just joy, just hope, sometimes love. Neither moved, as though each one thought the fragile reverie might break with even the blink of an eye. Then she pushed her face further into the crook of his neck and kissed his shoulder. They'd had boundary lines. Bosch had told her that this was not his purpose in inviting her to stay with him, and she had said it would never come to that, because she had lost that part of herself, the capacity to connect. But now here they were. Bosch wondered if this was her goodbye, if she would be gone tomorrow. He put his hand on her back and moved his thumb and forefinger like an inchworm down her spine. He thought he heard a smothered giggle. If it was, he had never heard it before. "I don't want you to go," he whispered, "even if this never happens again, even if it was a mistake. I don't want you to go. Not yet." She raised herself up and looked at him in the darkness. He could see a slight glint in her dark eyes. He could feel her breasts against his chest. She kissed him. It was not a long, impassioned kiss like the one she had started with. It was a quick kiss on the lips, and then she climbed off. "Is that a champagne bucket?" she asked. "You knew I was coming in?" "No," Bosch said quickly. "I mean, it is a champagne bucket, but I use it for the ice pack for my knee."
"Oh.
Why don't you stay in here tonight?"
"No, I like my bed."
"Good night, Harry." She moved toward the door. "Good night," Bosch whispered. She closed the door behind her. Bosch stared at it in the darkness for a long time.
Ballard. Chapter 20. It was 1 a.m. and well into her official shift before Ballard completed the paperwork that went along with the arrest and booking of Theodore Bechtel on suspicion of breaking and entering and grand theft. After he was secured in a solo cell at the station, she walked through the parking lot to the storage rooms and retrieved a fresh box of shake cards. Once back in the detective bureau, she set up in a back corner and soon was sifting through the reports on the human tumbleweeds, as Tim Farmer called them, that drifted across the streets of Hollywood on a nightly basis. After an hour, she had put 6 cards aside for further consideration and follow-up. Several hundred did not make the cut. Her forward progress was slowed when she came across another card written by Farmer. His words and observations held her once again. "This kid knows nothing better than the street. If he was put into a one-bedroom apartment with a full kitchen, he'd move into the closet and sleep on the floor. He's one of the Rain people." She wondered who the Rain people were in Farmer's estimation. People who couldn't fit in with the rest of society? People who needed the rain? Her rover squawked, and Lieutenant Monroe called her to the watch office. She took the long way, going down the rear hallway of the station and then up to the front. This allowed her to see who was in the station and maybe get a sense of what was happening before speaking to Monroe. But the station was empty, as it was on most nights. Monroe was standing behind his desk, looking down at the deployment screen, which showed the locations of cars and personnel in the field. He didn't look up, but knew she had entered the room.
"Ballard, we've got a hot shot, and I need you to get out there and honcho it," he said.
"What's the call?" Ballard asked.
"A woman calls in, says she's locked in the bathroom of a house up on Mount Olympus. Says she's been raped and managed to get to the bathroom with her cell phone. Says the guy's still there, trying to break the door down. I rolled 2 units and a sergeant. They get there, and guess who the guy is? Danny fucking Monahan. It's a he said, she said, and I want you out there to make the call."
"Did they transport the victim to the rape center?"
"Nope, she's still there. She took a shower while she was in the bathroom."
"Shit. They should have transported her anyway."
"They're not sure she's a victim, Ballard. Just get out there and see for yourself. This should be right up your alley."
"What's that mean?"
"Whatever you want it to mean. Just get up there, and don't forget your rover."
He handed a slip of paper over the screen to her. It had the address written on it and the name and age of the person reporting the incident. Chloe Lambert, 22. Ballard was in her city ride, heading back toward the hills within 5 minutes. She hated cases involving celebrities. Things always had a different reality to them. It wasn't normal life. Danny Monahan was a stand-up comic who had broken big in the last 5 years with podcasts and cable specials, and now a growing string of hit movies that steadily broke the $100 million mark at the box office. He was a triple threat and a major force to contend with in Hollywood. It seemed appropriate that he would live in a part of the Hollywood Hills known as Mount Olympus. Ballard hit the blue lights and streaked down Sunset to Crescent Heights, where she turned north toward Laurel Canyon. The neighborhoods of Mount Olympus covered the front right shoulder of the canyon, with large homes that peaked at the lights of the city down in the flats. Ballard pulled into the driveway of a house on Electra Drive and parked behind one of the patrol cars. She was met in the driveway by Sergeant Dvorak.
"We won't need a spacesuit tonight, Sally Ride," he said.
"Good," Ballard said. "What will I need?"
"The wisdom of Solomon, I guess. She says he's an ass bandit, and he says she's setting him up for a Me Too moment."
"Why didn't you transport her to the RTC, Stan?" Dvorak held his hands up as if to calm her.
"Just hold on, hold on. I didn't want to make the call on that because if she gets transported, then there's a case number, and this guy's life and career go down the toilet."
The male bias was no shock to Ballard, but now wasn't the time to call Dvorak on it.
Okay, where are they? She asked.
I've got Monahan sitting snug as a bug in the home office, and the girl is...
The girl?
Woman, whatever. She's in the screening room on the other side of the house. Nobody's touched anything in the bedroom or talked to the suspect.
Well, you did that right. I'm going to talk to the woman first. Show me. Dvorak led the way into a massive home that appeared to be a conjoining of circular structures of different sizes. The center circle was the tallest. The entryway was at least 2 stories high.
She's this way, Dvorak said.
They walked through a massive entertaining area with a small stage and microphone in one corner, where Ballard guessed Monahan practiced his stand-up routines or performed for invited guests and family. Then they moved into a hallway and toward an open door where a blue suitor named Gina Gardner was standing post. Gigi, Ballard said as she passed. She entered a home theater with a large curtained screen at the front. 4 rows of plush leather lounge chairs, 12 in all, were on stepped levels going toward the rear. Posters from Monahan's movies and in various languages lined the walls. Sitting on the edge of one of the lounge chairs was a young woman wearing a man's bathrobe. She was blonde, with large doe eyes. Her cheeks were streaked with makeup that had run down her face with tears. Dvorak presented the victim and then backed into the hallway with Gardner. Ballard held out her hand. Chloe, I'm Detective Ballard. I'm here to hear your story and to make sure you get whatever medical treatment you need.
I just need to go home, but they won't let me. He's still here. I'm scared.
You are perfectly safe. There are 6 police officers in the house, and he's being held in a room on the other side. I just want to get some basic information from you, and then we'll take you for medical examination and treatment. I'm going to record your statement.
Okay.
Ballard sat on the edge of the lounge chair next to Chloe's and put the small digital recorder she always carried between them. Once she started to record, she identified herself and the victim and gave the time, date, and location of the interview. Chloe, how long have you known Danny Monahan?
Tonight was when I met him.
Where was that?
At the comedy room. I went with my friend Aisha tonight, and he was there. He did stand up, and then I met him at the bar in the back. He invited me up here.
What about Aisha?
No, just me.
Did you drive here in your own car?
No, I had Ubered. I mean, to the comedy room. He drove me here in his car.
Do you know what kind of car it was?
It was a Maserati, but I don't know, like, which model it was.
That's okay. So you came here on an invitation. You weren't forced.
No. I even had sex with him, and I wanted to. But then later he... God, this is so embarrassing.
She started crying again. It's okay, Chloe. Nothing that happened is your fault. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. You were not the...
He rolled me over and raped me in the ass. I told him to stop, but he wouldn't. I said no. I said no several times, but he wouldn't stop.
She said it rapid fire, like it was the one and only time she would be able to say it. Are you hurt, Chloe?
Yes, I'm bleeding.
Okay, I have to ask you this question, and I apologize ahead of time. Had you ever had anal sex before this occurred with Danny Monahan?
No, never. I think it's disgusting.
Okay, Chloe, that's all for now. I'm going to get you to a rape treatment center, where they're going to look for biological evidence and treat you for your injuries. They'll also be able to talk to you about counseling and what steps to take from there.
I just want to go home.
I know, but this is a necessary stage in the investigation. We need to do this, okay?
Okay, I guess.
Okay, you wait here. Officer Gardner is going to be outside the door at all times, and I'll be back soon. When she stepped out through the door, Dvorak was gone. Gardner gave her a head wave, and they walked up the hall so they could confer without Chloe hearing them. Gardner had 10 years on the job, all of them at Hollywood Division. She was petite and wore her dark hair tied up in the back. "She has her cell," Gardner said. I heard her whispering on a call. "Okay," Ballard said. "Just so you know, I heard her say, this guy's going to pay. I'm going to be rich." Ballard pointed to the body cam affixed to her uniform. "You think that picked it up?" "I don't know. Maybe. Make sure I get the video file at the end of shift. I want you to write up a report as well. Anything else?" "Nope. Just that." "Thanks." "Sure thing." Ballard found Dvorak in the entertaining area and asked him to take her to the bedroom. It was a large round room with a round bed and a round mirror on the ceiling above it. Ballard kept her hands in her pockets as she leaned over the bed and looked down at the knot of sheets and pillows. She saw no blood or anything else that might constitute evidence. She went into the bathroom, which featured a large round jacuzzi in the center. She inspected a large white-tiled shower stall, but saw no blood or other evidence. In a wastebasket next to the toilet, she saw a wad of blood-stained tissues. "Okay, we're going to need to call out a field unit to collect everything," she said. "Can you make the call while I talk to the suspect?"
"You got it," Dvorak said. "I'll take you over to him first."
Danny Monahan was sitting behind a desk that was notable to Ballard because it wasn't big and it wasn't round. It was old and scratched, and that told her it had sentimental value to the comic genius sitting behind it.
"You noticed the desk, huh?" he said. "I was a school teacher once. Not many people know that."
Monahan was mid-30s, paunchy with success, his red hair too long, overly styled, and cut to look like he had just rolled out of bed and run his hands through it. A guy who cared about his looks, but trying to look like he didn't. Ballard ignored the reveal about the desk. "Mr. Monahan, I'm Detective Ballard. Has anyone read you your rights?"
"My rights? No. Come on, this is a shakedown. She wants money. She told me she would bleed me dry."
Ballard showed him her digital recorder and turned it on. She then recited the Miranda rights warning and asked Monahan if he understood them.
"Look, it might have gotten a little rough, but it wasn't anything she didn't ask for," he said.
"Mr. Monahan," Ballard insisted, "if you want to talk to me and explain what happened, then you need to acknowledge that you understand the rights I have recited to you. If not, then we're done here, and you are under arrest."
"Arrest? That is fucking absurd. This was completely consensual."
Ballard paused for a moment before speaking calmly and slowly. "One more time," she said. "Do you understand your rights as they have been explained to you?"
"Yes, I understand my rights," Monahan said. "Happy now?"
"Do you want to talk to me about what happened here in your home tonight?"
"Sure, I'll talk, because it's all bullshit. It's a con. She wants money, Detective. You can't see that?"
Ballard put the recorder down on Monahan's old teaching desk. She again stated the time and location, as well as Monahan's name and his agreement to give a recorded statement. "Tell me what happened. This is your chance." Monahan spoke matter-of-factly, as if describing what he had for dinner.
"I met her at the club tonight, and then I took her home and fucked her. That's what happened, and it's what I do all the time. But this time, she gets up and runs into the bathroom, locks the door, and starts yelling rape."
"Did you try to break through the door to the bathroom?"
"Nope."
"Let's go back to the sex. Did she at any time say no or tell you to stop?"
"No. She stuck her ass up and said go for it. Anything else is a lie."
It was a classic he said, she said case, as Lieutenant Monroe had warned and as many rape cases reported to the LAPD were. But
But Ballard had seen the blood in the wastebasket, and she knew that would tip consideration toward Chloe's side of the story. The results of the examination at the rape treatment center could also be probative if the victim's injuries were quantifiable. The blood in the basket seemed to indicate that they would be. Arresting a celebrity in a celebrity town was risky business. The cases drew massive attention, and the accused usually hired the best and brightest legal teams. The defense would do a deep dive into Ballard's life and career, and she knew, as surely as she was standing there, that her history as a complainant about sexual harassment in the department would be brought up and likely used to paint her as biased in favor of the female. She realized she could back out at this point. The celebrity involvement would easily qualify this investigation as a downtown case. The newly formed sexual harassment task force should be called out. But Ballard also realized that the way the system worked could put other women in jeopardy. Her passing the buck here would result in a slow and methodical investigation, during which Monahan would not be arrested or in any way removed from his life and routines. It might be weeks before the case was presented to the district attorney's office for charges. But Monahan had just said he did this often, brought a woman up from the comedy clubs down below. Did he do what he did to Chloe to every woman he brought to the round bedroom? Ballard could not risk that her acting out of career caution or department protocol might lead to other women being victimized. Ballard called Dvorak in from the hallway, then turned back to Monahan. "Mr. Monahan, stand up," she said. "You're under arrest for..."
"Wait, wait, wait," Monahan yelled. "Okay, okay, look. I didn't want to do this, but I can prove to you there was no rape. Just let me show you. There will be no arrest, I guarantee it."
Ballard looked at him for a moment, then glanced at Dvorak.
"You have 5 minutes," she said. "We have to go to my bedroom," Monahan said. "That's a crime scene."
"No, it's not a crime scene.
I have the whole thing on video. You look at it, you'll see. No rape."
Ballard realized she should have seen that coming. The mirror on the ceiling. Monahan was a voyeur.
"Let's go," she said.
Monahan led the police procession to the bedroom, stating his case along the way.
"Look, I know what you're thinking, but I'm not a creep," he said. "But with all this Me Too stuff starting up last year, I thought I needed protection, you know?"
"You put in cameras," Ballard said.
"Damn right. I knew it might come to this.
I didn't do it for me to watch. That would be sick. I just needed the protection." In the bedroom, he went to a remote control on a stand next to the bed and turned on a large screen that mirrored the curve of the wall. Soon the screen split into 16 views from security cameras around the house. He highlighted one of the squares and expanded it. Ballard was now looking at an overhead view of the room that included her, Dvorak, and Monahan. Ballard turned to locate the camera and focused on the ornate frame of a painting on the wall near the head of the bed.
"Okay, now we just rewind," Monahan said.
Ballard turned back. 2 minutes later, they were watching Monahan and Chloe Lambert have sex on the bed. There was no sound, and thankfully it was a wide-angle lens. Ballard assumed that the action on the screen could be blown up, but that was not necessary for her to see what was obviously a consensual coupling.
"That was the first time we did it," Monahan said. "Then we took a little nap. You want me to fast forward to the main event?"
"Please," Ballard said. Monahan sped forward to the second round of sex, and it became clear through Lambert's body language and posturing that she had initiated the second go and the specific act of anal sex. When it was over, she walked calmly to the bathroom and closed the door. Monahan started to fast forward the playback again.
"So here is where I hear her on the phone in there calling the cops."
He switched to normal playback, and they watched as he jumped naked from the bed and rushed to the bathroom door. He leaned his head to the jamb like he was listening to the phone call Lambert was making, then started pounding the side of his fist against the door.
You can turn it off, Ballard said. I'm going to need a copy.
No way, Monahan said. Why?
Because it's evidence. I'm going to arrest her for filing a false report.
I don't want her arrested. I just want you to get her the fuck out of here. You think I want every broad I've banged this year to know I have them on tape? Why do you think I didn't tell you about this from the start? I'm not pressing any charges. Just get her out of here.
Mr. Monahan, it doesn't matter if you don't want to press charges. She made the false report to the police.
Well, I won't cooperate, and I'll hire the best fucking lawyer in the country to stop you from getting the video. You want that fight?
You know, sir, I could also charge you with recording a sexual encounter without both parties' knowledge and consent. Monahan computed the ramifications of that for a few moments before speaking.
Don't you think decisions like this are above your pay grade, detective?
You want me to call my commander? Or better yet, the sex harassment task force that leaks to the media like a sieve?
If you want, I'll call the chief of police at home. I'm sure everybody on the food chain will be totally discreet about this.
Monahan's face revealed that he was realizing the can of worms he was opening up.
Sorry, my bad, he said. I think you are probably perfectly capable of deciding how best to handle this.
10 minutes later, Ballard returned to the home theater where Chloe Lambert was waiting. She dropped the clothes she had collected from the bedroom on the floor in front of her.
You can get dressed, Ballard said.
What's happening?
Lambert asked.
Nothing's happening. You're going home.
You're lucky you're not going to jail.
Jail? What for?
Filing a false report.
You weren't raped, Chloe.
What the fuck? That guy's a predator.
Maybe, but so are you. He has the whole thing on video.
I watched it.
So you can stop the act. Get dressed and I'll have you driven down the hill.
Ballard turned to leave, but then hesitated and looked back.
You know, it's women like you that... She didn't finish. She believed it would be lost on Chloe Lambert.
Chapter 21. Ballard was depressed. She left the Monahan estate, not knowing which of the two people she had interviewed was the more loathsome example of the human form. And yet, neither would face consequences for their actions of the night. She decided to focus her enmity on Chloe as a betrayer of the cause. For every noble movement or advancement in the human endeavor across time, there were always betrayers who set everything a step back. She tried to shake it off as she came through the back door of the station and headed down the hallway to the detective bureau. She had a half box of FI cards she wanted to finish before the end of her shift. She checked her watch. It was 4:15 a.m. Her plan was to write up a report on the call-out to Electra Drive. She would pull no punches, naming all parties in the investigation and describing their actions, even though the investigation had come to nothing so far. She would file it in the detective commander's inbox, and it would be someone else's decision from there. It might go down to the task force, and it might even make it to the DA's office for consideration. Along the way, it might also get leaked to the media. No matter how it went, she was passing the buck on it, and that did not sit well with her. She could have arrested them both on the spot for different crimes, but such a move would have resulted in her actions being studied and questioned by a command staff that didn't like her or want her. Some fault would likely be found, and she would be further buried by the department and pulled away from the one thing she needed most. Her job on the Late Show. She turned into the detective bureau and headed to the back corner where she had set up for work earlier. She was nearly there when she saw the familiar head of gray curly hair over one of the half walls of the workstation. Bosch. When she got to him, she saw that he was looking through the last 4-inch stack of cards from the storage box she had brought in.
So they just let you waltz in here anytime you like? She said by way of a greeting. To be honest, I sort of let myself in tonight, Bosch said. They never took my 999 key when I quit.
Ballard nodded.
Well, I have to write a report. I won't be able to look at shake cards till I file. I'm on the last stack here. I'll go out back and get another box.
I'd better go with you. Let's do it now before I settle in and start writing. I can tell you the latest on John the Baptist on the way.
They headed back through the station and out the rear door to the parking lot. Ballard updated Bosch on her return to the Moonlight Mission and interview with McMullen. She said that her gut instinct was still that McMullen wasn't their guy. She told him about the headcount he kept on his calendars and the photo of Daisy she had found.
So you actually placed him with the victim, Bosch said. He knew her.
He baptized her several months before the murder, Ballard said.
But come on, she was a night dweller, and he roams Hollywood at night, looking for souls to save. I would be surprised if they didn't cross paths.
I still don't think there's anything there, and I might have an alibi for McMullen's van.
She told him about the van being in the shop on the night of the abduction and murder.
McMullen looked it up and left me a message about the place, she said. As soon as they open this morning, I'm going to see if I can confirm that the van was there when Daisy got taken. If I do, then I think we move on from John the Baptist.
Bosch said nothing, indicating he was not ready to scratch the missionary man off the list of potential suspects.
So, what's happening with your search warrant case? Ballard asked.
We got part of the way there, Bosch said. We found the bullets we were looking for, but they were no good for comparison. And then my source ended up dead out in Alhambra.
Oh, shit. And it's connected?
Looks that way. Done in by his own gang. LAPD SWAT arrested the shooter last night in Sylmar. He wasn't talking when I left, but he's known to be tight with our suspect on the cold case. Sometimes when you blow dust off an old investigation, bad things happen.
Ballard looked at him in the dim light of the parking lot. She wondered if that was some kind of warning about the Daisy Clayton case.
They walked silently the rest of the way to the storage facility. Once there, they each picked up a box of FI cards and headed back to the station. Ballard turned and assessed the boxes in the hallway before leaving. They were about halfway through. Walking back across the lot, Bosch stopped for a breather and put his box on the trunk of a black and white.
I've got a bad knee, he explained. I get acupuncture when it acts up. Just haven't had the time.
I've heard that knee replacements are better than the real thing these days, Ballard said.
I'll keep that in mind. That would take me out of the game for a while. I might never get back.
He picked up the box and pressed on.
I was thinking, he said. You remember the GRASP program? Were you here then?
I was on patrol, Ballard said. Get a grasp on crime? I remember. A PR stunt.
Well, yeah, but I think that was still going strong when Daisy got taken. And I was wondering what happened to all that data they collected. I thought, if it was still around somewhere, we might get another angle on the lay of the land in Hollywood at the time of the murder.
GRASP was indeed a public relations ploy by a former chief who took the reins of the department and touted a law enforcement think tank idea of studying crime through geography to help determine how people and facilities were targeted. It was revealed with much fanfare by the department, but suffered a quiet death a few years later when a new chief with new ideas came in.
I don't remember what it stood for, Ballard said.
I was on patrol in Pacific Division, and I remember filling out the forms on the MDC. Geographic something or other.
Geographic Reporting and Safety Program, Bosch said.
The guys down in the ass office really worked some OT on it.
Ass office?
The acronym selection section. You never heard of it? They got about 10 guys down there full time.
Ballard started laughing as she lifted her knee, held her box with one hand on her thigh,
and used her keycard to open the door of the station. She then opened it with her hip and let Bosch in first. They walked down the hallway. "I'll look into the GRASP files," she said. "I'll start at the ass office. Let me know what you find." Back at the workstation, Ballard noticed the blue binder that had been left at her spot. She flipped it open. "What's this?" she asked.
"I told you I'd started a new murder book for the reinvestigation," Bosch said. "I figured you would want to start adding to it, maybe do a chrono. I think it should stay with you."
There were only a few reports in the binder at the moment. One was Bosch's summary of his interview with the supervisor at American Storage Products about the container that he believed Daisy Clayton's body had been stuffed into. "Good," she said. "I'll print out everything I have and put it in. I already have an online chrono going." She flipped the binder closed and saw that it was old and the blue plastic faded. Bosch was recycling an old murder book, and it didn't surprise her. She guessed that he had the records from several old cases in his home. He was that kind of detective. "Did you close the one this came from?" she asked.
"I did,"
Bosch said. "Good," she said. They went back to work. There were no more call-outs for Ballard that shift. She got her report writing finished and filed, and then joined Bosch on the FI cards. By dawn, they had made it through the two boxes they brought from storage. 50 more cards were added to the stack that warranted a second look, but did not rise to the level of requiring immediate action. As they worked through the cards, they had talked, and Bosch had told her stories about his days in Hollywood homicide in the 1990s. She noticed that he, or in some instances, the media, had given names to many of his cases. The woman in the suitcase, the man with no hands, the doll maker, and so on. It was as though homicides back then were an event. Now it seemed that nothing was new, nothing shocked. Ballard gathered their two stacks of keepers together along with the murder book. "I'm going to put these in my locker and then go over to the auto repair shop," she said. "You want to go with me? To the shop, I mean."
"No," Bosch said. "I mean, I do, but I think I better get up to the valley and see where we are on things. Maybe I'll see if I can get some pins stuck in my knee on the way."
"Let's check in later, then. I'll let you know what I get."
"That's a plan."
Chapter 22 Ballard stopped for a latte after leaving the station. While waiting for it, she got a text from Aaron saying he was off all day. She took this to mean that the man he had pulled from the riptide had not survived, and Aaron was given a therapy day to deal with it. She texted him back and said she